This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. Happy birthday, Rahul.
Oh, thank you, Ben.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. This is a big one for you.
This is.
Tell us about it. What have you learned in your half a century on this planet?
You know, wow, you go right into it. This is fantastic.
I mean, the big 5-0.
It is. And it actually really feels like a big deal. And it's not a midlife crisis type of thing, more of a reflection back. And I kind of look and people have been asking me, like, what would you have done differently in your life if you had the chance? And I've got zero regrets. I'm so blessed to have an awesome wife, awesome boys, awesome family, awesome career. It's crazy. So I'm super happy. And my wife threw a big party and we missed you, Ben. But I wanted to actually to illustrate sort of a little bit of my background. My middle son gave a speech at the birthday, and can I just play it for you really quick?
Sure. I'd love to hear it.
And I want to get your honest feedback here. He's 14, by the way. He's the one that Roger Dodd said, I may have to put him in therapy because I made him run.
You never want to take advice from Roger Dodd.
Okay, you ready?
Hello. I'm Sam. Favorite. And like tonight it was really important because like my dad, he doesn't really talk about what he was like as a kid, and I've been going around and they've been talking about him like he was like some bad kid. I'm like, I didn't even know him that well, so like my mom is like, she had straight A's and she was like really good and she went to Northwestern. And then me, I was like, I'm not like your normal customary Indian child. I don't have all A's. Some of my teachers hate me. I get posted on our town's Instagram for like ding dong ditching. So I wonder like where I got it from. I didn't get it from my mom, I know that. And I know I got it from my dad. So I was going around and I was talking to some of like the people that knew him when he was young, and then like pardon my language, but they were like, he's a little shit. I was like, no way. Like, I thought my dad, you know, whenever I do something wrong, he's like, you shouldn't like do that. And I'm like, oh, like, and I'm like, now I have like a lot of stories against him. Like, he doesn't tell me much about like who he was. Like, I know who he was out of college, but like as a kid, nobody really talks about who he was. And, so, like, I'm glad to know that, like, I wasn't creating, like, it's just like, you know, he's a good guy, but much. You know, I haven't, you know, my dad always shows up to my games all the time. He's just, he's always been there. You know, he's a great guy, and he's a very big inspiration to me. So
that's fantastic.
I say happy birthday.
Isn't that amazing? So what do you think?
There's a lot to unpack there, Rahul. First of all, he definitely has a future, I think, being hired out for best man speeches at weddings. He obviously adores his dad. And I think that's the biggest takeaway. And it's really sweet that he would get up and speak like that. And he was obviously having a good time with it. But it's so cool to have your son get up and talk about you like that, even though he was obviously, a lot of it was attempting to be humorous and give you a hard time. But
totally.
I think it's great. I think it's great.
You know what's amazing that I was super impressed with them about is I don't think I, even to this day, I don't think I have that level of comfort where I could be in front of 170 people of totally different life experiences, family members, you know, my partners were there. You got all of my friends from childhood, law school, college, and just look at this sea of adults and just speak directly, you know, talking about even himself and being reflective on the criticisms he's getting as an individual from his teachers or from the community, if there is any. It was really cute, the ding-dong ditching issue. But I just don't have that lack of filter, for lack of a better word. And I was just so proud of him and so envious that he doesn't have that issue. It's pretty cool.
It definitely didn't seem scripted.
No.
I don't know if he had notes or anything, but it was just...
I didn't even know he was going to speak, to be honest. So when Smitha just goes in, Shale's going to speak, I looked at him, I go, you are? And then that happened.
Oh, that's great. That's, well, maybe a future trial lawyer in our midst.
He did say once, this was maybe a few months ago, 4 or 5 months ago, he goes, hey, Dad, let's just say I don't do the best in school, but I end up in law school and, you know, I don't do that great there. Will there be a job at Panache Ravipoti for me? It's like, no, we only hire excellent lawyers. And that's not a good resume the way you're describing it. He set the bar low for trying to become a lawyer. So
I don't know. I think nepotism is in these days. So, well, this is kind of a good segue to our topic of today's show. We do not have a guest, which I think is refreshing for a change. We can do something a little bit different. We were reflecting on the fact that we've now been doing this for 3.5 years, which is incredible, actually. And I think we've recorded over 75 episodes and have in the range of about 80,000 downloads. So our little venture's taken off, done pretty well. So today we thought we'd just kind of take a look backward, reflect on some of the things we've done and learned through the show, and maybe look forward at what lessons we've taken and how to apply those into the future. One of the things that has obviously come up in our show and generally in the world of trial lawyers is we seem to be in a golden age of verdicts. I mean, there are bigger, more big verdicts now than there have ever been before, and not just bigger by a margin, bigger by multiples. In some cases, many multiples, and records are being set everywhere in venues all over this country, and many of our guests participated in some of those. So the first topic I want to throw out there is why? Why do you think that's happening now? What accounts for that?
So I've seen a bunch of articles about this, and I have one thought, and it's kind of the reason why we started this podcast was to galvanize the plaintiff trial bar and learn from everybody across the country, all of these amazing lawyers, on what makes them tick, not just as human beings, but also pull a little bit from them about techniques they've used in trial and things that they've been able to do to connect with jurors, to communicate, and to get the truth, to be the strongest standing beacon in that courtroom. And through learning on this podcast, other podcasts, trial communities, I think when the pandemic started, there was no more cohesive group of people who are all focused on why they became lawyers in the first place, which was to help others and help victims in bad situations, particularly corporate negligence, and make sure that everybody was capable of advocating on behalf of their clients effectively. I personally think the plaintiff trial bar in sharing and collaborating has really, really helped get fairer verdicts out there on a more consistent level. And then I think there's always the concept of all of the efforts of tort reform that have been done and propaganda over the last several decades. I think it's faded away when people are starting to actually see, just as a society, their frustrations with corporations and the massive levels of profit they take at the harm of their customers, constituents, and so on. So that's got to have some version of interplay on it as well. What are your thoughts on it, Ben?
Well, I agree with everything you said. And I think part of the success is the snowball effect. As people are getting better verdicts, they develop more confidence that they can, and also confidence asking for higher values or fair values. Whereas in the past, I think people may have undersold the case because they were worried and lacked that level of confidence. And that confidence itself can drive results. So I definitely think there's a lot of truth to that. I also think that with the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic, there was just a significant attitudinal shift in our country where the things sort of became flipped on their head. So institutions that had been paragons of respect and deference and that people trusted, whether it's the medical community or the law enforcement community, now coming out of the pandemic, in part because of our politics, there is a lot of skepticism of institutions, a lot of skepticism of corporations, and distrust of authority. And so as the anti-authority figures in a courtroom, being on the side of the plaintiff, we were always running uphill against the authority figures that generally the mainstream of America deferred to and trusted. And now it's sort of the opposite. And there's a way in which I feel a little bit guilty about that, because there are forces that are underlying that that are not necessarily all positive for our society, but have, I think, been very positive for plaintiffs in civil lawsuits. And one question I have about this is, where are we heading from here? Is this going to be the new normal? If it is, how long is it going to last? Is it sustainable? Or will that pendulum swing back? And will the defense bar figure out a solution to this? So far, they haven't, from what I can tell. What do you think about those questions?
No, I think those are great questions for us to think about. A lot of times, I just don't think about it. And part of it is that as an optimist and as somebody who thinks that we're doing this career, not just to help our clients, but for the bigger picture of prevention, there's a lot of ways that this pendulum swings in the other direction. And a lot of that control is in the control of the prospective defendants. And if there is a lot of effort put into prevention, if there is a lot of effort put into safe practices, they control their own destiny for the most part. So I'm not hoping that the pendulum swings in any other direction other than in the right direction to make sure that victims are fairly compensated, which I think is what's happening and what's been happening, and that things that happen to our clients don't happen again. And that's the part that I tragically don't see happening. I'm just not seeing that level of accountability transitioning into better practices.
It's something I do think about a lot, because in building a law firm, you're thinking about building out capacity for the future. And should we be adding lawyers? Should we be adding staff? Should we be ramping up because things are really good right now? But where does that tipping point come where maybe you're overbuilding, and then if things slow down or there's, you know, systemic changes, you've overextended yourself? So, I mean, I think our solution to that is we've built slowly over time, and we don't want to rush to add huge capacity all at once, but just gradually build it up. How has that affected your firm practice? Are you in a growth mode?
Yeah, I mean, we're always in the same mode, which is if there's excellent lawyers that want to join the firm, then that's really what we're looking at. We're never looking to grow just for the purpose of growing. So it really is just more opportunity-based, where if the situation presents itself, then that's fantastic. But there's a different component. I always think of law firms as five-year-old kids, that as they grow and they grow in different proportions at different places. And so right when you've got the staff in the perfect spot, so that five-year-old with that shirt that fits right, all of a sudden, you know, the pants don't fit right. And so then you've got to adjust on that. And then right when you get the pants fitting right, all of a sudden the shoes are not fitting. And then there's always constant adjusting and tweaking so that everything is actually fitting right. And then right when you get there, you've got to readjust again anyways.
That is, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that is the perfect analogy. I mean, you add a lawyer and that means you need another paralegal. And then when you need another paralegal, you need another legal assistant. Well, you have too many intakes, so you need to deal with that. And then you've got to add another, you know, that is how it works. Exactly. In our 3.5 years of doing this and thinking about kind of some of the themes that have come through, what are some of the big ones for you and takeaways and things that maybe you've implemented in your own practice or given greater thought to?
We started off.
And I'm sorry, I keep putting you on the spot.
No, you know, the same question's coming right back at you. So these are great because I've been thinking about this. And actually, we started with a giant bang with our podcast because we had Rick Friedman on first. That was such an influential podcast for me because he said something that just resonated so hard with me and so deep, which is that the life of a trial lawyer, you know, it's not a long shelf life if you don't take care of yourself. And one of the things that I know I did and still do is I wear my client's injury on my shoulders. I carry it. And their loss is something that I feel like I'm responsible in every way, shape, and form to remedy. And if I don't, then I don't even know what I would do with myself. And that level of stress, as Rick was explaining during that first podcast, is something that is actually an anchor holding us down as opposed to something that you think is motivating you to do the best for your client. If you live with that type of fear, then your decisions, whether it's a little bit or a lot, get impacted by that fear of failing because you feel like you've failed your client. And so he was just explaining, he said, the reality is you didn't put your client in that wheelchair. You didn't put your client in whatever situation they're in. You're here to help them and you're going to do your best, but it's not your fault. And when he said that, I was like listening and I thought, you know I hear you. It makes total sense. What am I going to do about this? And so I actually worked hard on changing my state of mind. And I may have told you about this, Ben, but you know, when I did that jiu-jitsu trial last year in San Diego, I took Rick's advice to heart. And I said, my client, who's an incomplete quadriplegic, I didn't do it to him, but I'm here to help and I'm going to do my best. And if it doesn't work out, it's not because I didn't do my best and he's going to be okay. And I had the most fun in that trial. And I think I was the most creative in that trial that I've been in almost every, maybe any trial I've ever tried before. And that sense of having fun and enjoying myself and connecting with the jury and being creative and taking some chances, I don't think I would have done that if that first podcast didn't happen. So just kind of the takeaways from things like that.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. And how did you do that? How did you get yourself to, because that's easy to say, but very hard to do, because the impact of that, the stress, anxiety, fear that's coming from your association with your client's injuries and feeling responsible for fixing the client and winning for the client. I mean, that's all at a very deep subconscious level. So how do you go about changing that mindset and actually reducing that stress, anxiety, and fear associated with that? Did you have to go to counseling, or did you manage to do that on your own?
No, it was pulling the subconscious into my consciousness, right? So I was being very deliberate for years, because that was 3.5 years ago, that first podcast, right? So after that, when I went to trial, I didn't succeed in kind of just saying, hey, let me just go have fun and take this burden off my shoulders. I was still being who I was, you know, but consciously recognizing that I didn't need to be that way. And is that really helping me? And slowly but surely able to put myself in that position where at least during that trial, I was able to liberate myself of that. Now, do I not quickly and easily want to fall back into my old state of mind where it is all on me and I'm going to feel absolutely horrible if it doesn't go right, despite my best efforts? All the time. And so I think what's going to happen in my next trial, I'm just going to have to consciously get myself back into that spot where Rick was advising, and then get myself into that state of mind as I try that case. And I'm hoping that at some point soon, I don't need to motivate myself to get myself out of this burden, and that I'm just naturally in that state of mind, but I'm not quite there yet.
That's a huge development. Congratulations. And I'm sure that makes you much more effective in the courtroom if you're able to liberate yourself in that way. I mean, from my perspective, I can certainly relate to your feeling that you take on your client's injuries and on your shoulders. I've actually had this very weird experience that is, I quite literally develop the injuries involved in our cases sometimes. And there's scientific foundation for this. I can't remember what the term for it is, but I recall trying a heart attack case. And in the lead up to the heart attack case, I developed palpitations and had to call the cardiologist. Now, Maine's such a small state that in that case, when I called the cardiologist, I was put through to the cardiologist who also was the defense expert in the very case that I was just about to try. So it was a little too close to home, and then decided after that I was going to get my medical care in Boston. And then we recently tried a prostate cancer case, and one of our client's symptoms was that he had, you know, urinary issues and an incomplete stream and various things. And in the lead up to the trial, I started to develop urinary issues. And it became a running joke around our firm. And every time I'd go to the men's room, I'd come back and say, I had an incomplete stream, or, you know, and, but it's weird. It's really weird when your brain gets fixated on something. It actually has a physical impact on your body. And I've become conscious of that. And there's a funny aspect to it, but it's also really not that funny, because you're physically suffering in a certain way. I mean, in a way, I think it gives you great empathy for your clients, because you're relating to them on a deep level, but it would be better not to have to endure that. And I feel like one of the big themes and takeaways from all of the guests that we've had that are really successful at trying cases is this. What you just said is, to the extent you can liberate yourself to be yourself in the courtroom, to show your authentic nature, to relate to people on a human level that's not overly scripted, that's, you're obviously going to be very well prepared, but that preparation leads to spontaneity and to creativity and to using your natural voice and language that's not heavily peppered with legal phrases or Latin words, but just common sense, talking to people on a very direct, open human level. that's where you get to the next level in this practice, where you're getting, where you're connecting to people in a way that I think most lawyers can't, aren't capable of doing that in a courtroom. I mean, I was struck with the podcast we had with Briggs Medigian, where he and John Stefanuka, his partner, basically said they're going in and trying these very complicated birth injury cases with no notes, with no script. They don't write out openings. They don't write out closings. They don't write out cross-examinations. They just go in and sort of improvise. Now, I've learned to take all of this with somewhat of a grain of salt, because you know these guys are super prepared and incredibly knowledgeable about the issues and the medicine and the science. And the idea, if someone's new to this, that you just go in and wing it, that's not the takeaway at all. But the takeaway is that you become so comfortable in your own skin and with your abilities that you can go in and perform in an authentic and very natural way. And I definitely think that that's a common theme among the lawyers that are, that become super successful as trial lawyers. And it really starts with what Rick was talking about in our very first podcast, of having to shed that layer of stress, fear, anxiety, to liberate yourself, to find that authentic voice that you have. Because even if you have the best intentions of that, when you're too stressed out, you become too rigid and too structured, too overly scripted and prepared. And the jury sees right through that. And they see you just as a lawyer person doing your lawyer thing, not as a someone having a conversation with them on a human level. Now, implementing that is harder than any other single thing you'll ever do in this profession, because every instinct you have, all of your training, and all of the incentive structures and fears guide you in the opposite direction, right? And you end up trying not to make mistakes because you're so afraid of the mistake, of the unforced error that's going to lose yourself the case. And go back to your very first point, Raul, of you taking on this burden and you're so afraid of not fulfilling that obligation. Or so it's just an interesting psychology, you know, and working through it, and you're doing it on a daily basis every day and trying to have the right balance there. And that, I think that's the heart of what we're doing.
Totally. And with Briggs and John, and I think the Cullen brothers also said the same thing, that they don't use the depositions of the defendants or experts, and then their notes are very limited when they go in their cross-examination. I struggled with that so much. You hit the nail on the head with those two podcasts and trying to, again, liberate yourself. But then sort of my trial philosophy is to be like that little kid with his parents. And what's that thing up in the sky? You know, the sun. And, you know, why is that there? And why? And distill and distill until the parent gets frustrated. But in working up a case and trying to make sure I can communicate to a jury, I always ask the, you know, well, why is that rule there? Why is it like that? Why? And why is it important? And so why do we need these comprehensive outlines? Is it to, as a crutch, or is it actually a value add? And if you've been doing it long enough and you already know what your themes are, then are the themes what you want to have on your notes, or do you want to have the particular question that you're going to ask because you're going to somehow forget what you're trying to accomplish up there? As I go through that exercise, after listening to Briggs, John, Joe, and Patrick, then I started to think, you know, I don't need it as much as I think I need it. And now I got to get myself to the next step of, I've accepted that I've over-documented my preparations for cross-examination. Now the next step is seeing if I can actually pull the trigger and not do that and give it a shot and see how it goes. Haven't quite gotten that far yet.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I mean, I recognize that I don't want to obviously be wedded to notes or an outline, but I haven't yet gotten to the point where I'm willing to give it up entirely like those guys do. I've noticed that often my best moments in a courtroom are where I get up to do my redirect or recross, where I don't have any notes and I'm just responding to something. And a lot of times that generates new developments that, you know, are less scripted, less predictable, and are better. So I want to take more opportunities to be in that position than going through some kind of a script, but I'm not yet at the point where I'm going to give it up completely. And, you know, I think part of this too is you don't want to, there's a fictional element to the lore of being a trial lawyer where people like to project things that aren't always entirely true, right? That someone like Brian Panish just steps into a courtroom unprepared and can just off the cuff crush anybody in cross, where anyone who knows people that are really successful at this knows how hard they prepare. And anybody who tells you they're going in and winging it, like Briggs and John, they may not use notes in the courtroom, but they're going in incredibly well prepared because knowing how complex those birth injury cases are and the science and medicine, you're just not going to be doing them at a high level unless you're prepared. So they just have a different strategy for it. And I do think if you were to break down the different people that have come on the podcast that have had great verdicts, many of them do use notes in the courtroom. And you could draw from their experience that the notes are very effective and very helpful. And the point of it is that you should do what works for you, that's authentic to you. You cannot be somebody different than who you are. And maybe Briggs and John have a different level of confidence, or maybe they have a different personality that's better suited to one particular approach. But, you know, Briggs made the point himself that he doesn't think that lawyers that use notes are any less effective. They just have a different approach to it. So recognizing that point, and you know, I don't know if Rick Friedman uses notes or he doesn't, but I suspect he probably does. So you know, I think the idea that there's a one-size-fits-all approach that is going to be equally effective for everybody is not correct. And the thing is to find what works well for you. Here's another topic that came through our shows, which is the idea of, it seems like in every case, there's one big issue, maybe two, but not more than one or two that are really the center of gravity in the case, that are the tipping point that is what allows you to win your case and the emotional force and traction to the case. Like in your jiu-jitsu case, you were able to identify the idea that people that saw this as high risk and that it was, you assume the risk of this when you go in and do something dangerous like martial arts, those people weren't going to be for you. But people who didn't feel that way would feel like there should be some basic safety rules in place to make sure that the uninitiated don't get paralyzed from the black belt instructor who's also calls himself a dangerous badass name that I forgot. So, but it feels like in every case, there's something like that. And sometimes it's the conduct of the defendant. Sometimes it's the defense being disingenuous in certain ways. Sometimes it's the conduct of the attorneys. And sometimes it may be your own client and their unique, compelling life story. So in every case, in retrospect, you can look and you can see, okay, this is the thing. And their lawyers give it different names. The I just can't get over it issue, the theme of the case, whatever you want to call it. But it's easy to identify that in retrospect. What's harder is to figure that out going forward into the trial. How do you identify that? And sometimes I feel like as lawyers, we're not that great at doing that because we're too close to the case. We're thinking about the case in certain analytical ways that are not how a jury is going to think about it. And the popular solution to this is data or focus groups. But I also think those things also have limitations because of there's natural biases built into that because we're the ones who are presenting the information to begin with. So the question is, and I'm very curious because every lawyer we've talked to has figured this out in a particular case. And I'm always curious how they figured that out. But how do you figure it out? And are there things we've learned now doing all these podcasts? You got a new case and you're bringing it to trial. What is that issue that's going to be outcome determinative in the case? And how do you go about figuring that out?
Oh, geez. I don't know if I have successfully determined what that actual pivot point is, that singular fact or concept which determines whether a case is going to be won or lost, any particular case. But I do think that we're not very good at finding that or maybe even searching for it. I don't even know if I'm actually consciously looking for that in gearing up for trial. What I do know is I think we're all pretty good at identifying what issues are going to lose a case. And so dealing with that, whether it's through Daubert motions and excluding experts who are going to be more of advocates rather than actually offering expert opinions, motions in limine to try and keep out facts that any person with common sense would go, that's not relevant to the case, but I could see how a jury would latch onto that and then all of a sudden torpedo the case. So kind of identifying all of the issues that could cause us to lose the case is an easy task to go through. It's just hard to put your finger on, is this what a jury is collectively, all 12 of them, are going to latch onto? And in retrospect, sometimes I think it's going to be issue A, and it turns out to be issue D that the jury latched onto. Or I get a split jury where half of them come and they say, you know, your point on this, that was what really moved me. But then the other half says it was a totally different thing. I get it half right. But the other thing is getting the defendants to make mistakes. And almost every time I've seen the jury come back and say, you know, I don't know why the defendant made this argument. And so kind of giving and making sure that you give the defense the opportunity to hurt themselves is not a bad thing to keep in play as well. But that's a really good question. And I don't even know if I've even really thought as deeply and as focused on that on the front end. How do you go about it?
I'm in a similar place as you in the sense that I think it's a very hard thing to do because, you know, the whole line of psychology that's reflected in that book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, and the way your brain works, both there's the analytical level and then there's the subconscious level. And there's that story in the book where somebody who was out at a forest fire, like in a split second as the fire was coming toward him, figured out that he would take his water bottle and spread the water around him and then spread his jacket down and he would hunker under the jacket and the fire like jumped over and went by him and he survived and everybody else, like hundreds and hundreds of other people, died. And asked afterward, how did he figure that out? His answer was just, I don't know. Like my brain just figured it out. But when you're thinking about it, if you were to sit down and be presented with the set of facts and then have to analyze what should I do under those circumstances, his brain likely would not have figured it out. And I feel like as lawyers, because we're so analytical, what we do is we try to think really hard about the facts in front of us and then like figure it out on an analytical level. And I often think that that process does not lead to the best result. It only leads to how a lawyer would analyze the case. And we overthink it a lot of times. And we also become pigeonholed into a way of thinking about the case that it's hard to come out of. And then once you commit to a certain approach to a case, then everything else you do follows that approach and you develop that confirmation bias, which is one of the things we're often arguing about the defense, that, I mean, the defendant, that they made a miscalculation often, and then they just continue to tell themselves that this was okay, but no one went back to think about it again and think critically about the issue. And that's why then you get the snowball of problems that leads to the harm to our clients a lot of times, particularly in the medical cases that I do. And so what I've really tried to make a conscious effort to do is to stop doing that at a minimum, to try to keep an open mind and to try to have a curiosity about the issues in the case and not to think of them in only one way, and to constantly question myself, like, why am I thinking that? And I mean, the defense is going to say this other thing about it. Well, maybe there's some truth to that. And if there is, like, how does that change my case? And what would the difference be if that set of facts was the state of the world versus the one that I think, you know, occurred or whatever? So I think it just, a lot of goes back to having this healthy curiosity about things. I'd always want to know why something and learn more about it and look it up or just understand it on a different level and just continue to ask those questions. And then if you do that enough, maybe if you're lucky, organically, that big picture issue will rise up out of that process. But that's the best I can offer for that.
You know, one of the things we've been talking about is just, I think we all believe in is making sure you're true to yourself and unauthentic in how you present a trial. That kind of leaves everything wide open that anything could work. It's just as long as it fits with your advocacy style. But do you have any thoughts on any concept of trial presentation, whether it be in voir dire, opening, closing, direct, or cross, which, at least in your mind, is a universal no-no? Doesn't matter how true it is to your style, you've got to divest yourself of that.
Absolutely. A lot of the guests we've had have covered different aspects of it. But one is that you don't want to talk like a lawyer. You don't want to use large words when you can use a small word that means the same thing. You don't want to be overly technical. You want to talk like an ordinary person. I think that you don't want to be an asshole. I mean, you don't have to be sycophantically kind to people that don't deserve your kindness, but you should not go overboard in trying to exact some kind of harsh punishment to someone who's on a witness stand and try to gain satisfaction out of being mean to people. And nobody likes a mean person, and nobody likes an angry person. And you can achieve just as much by being nice and friendly and respectful to people. And I think you should always be respectful to everybody, even if they're not being respectful to you. I think that brevity is certainly critical, and that if you can do something in half the time or shorter, then you should be very judicious about what you want to cover and make sure it's critically important. And if it isn't, you should leave it on the cutting room floor, because attention spans are short and there's definitely a trend in that direction that we continue to hear about and see. And I know there's a movement towards these rapid paced trials, and I haven't embraced that myself because I think it's one of those gimmicky things that I just don't think, you know, it's not a one size fits all thing. There may be a witness that you need to have on the stand a little bit longer. Sometimes your opening or closing needs to go a little bit longer. We're not automatons, and you got to be thoughtful about what you do. But in general, you want to be shorter than longer. Now, this answer is not proving that point. To me, those are some of the big takeaways. I'm sure there are others, but how about you?
I totally agree with you on all of that. And, you know, when you were talking about the don't be mean, just reminded me of that Jerry Spence story where he was trying this case and he believed he totally won it, like no brainer. And then jury comes out and rules against him. And so he was just baffled by it. And he talked to the jury afterwards. And one of the jurors said, "What happened? I thought I'd won this case." And she looked at him and said, "You had the defendant on the stand and you were crushing him and you were killing him. And then you kept killing him, killing him, killing him, killing him. And I thought, why do you have to be so mean?" And it was actually a turning point and affected the jury and led to him losing that particular case. That resonates with me, that everything we do has the potential to negatively impact the jury. And so we've got to be thoughtful about that as we're working through our trial presentation. One of the things that I feel in my own mind is an absolute, and it's going to be a little controversial. I don't think people should read their openings or closings. If you have your script and it's word for word and it's on a sheet of paper and that's how you're going through your closing, I just don't think that's going to be the single most effective way to advocate on behalf of your client. And there is some version of connection that needs to happen between you and each and every one of those jurors. And that connection really happens with eye contact. And so I think that kind of puts you at a disadvantage if you're going to stand behind a lectern, which is a physical separation between you and the jury, and then not have eye contact with them so that you could have a really nice transcript that the court reporter will look at and you could read later and say, "How eloquent is that?" But when you actually see it unfold live from a juror's perspective, I don't know if it's going to have that same effect.
I would agree with that. And I think that there's more tolerance, I think, now for imperfection in speaking. I mean, I think we have a president with a stutter. We have a former president, you can't string more than one or two sentences in the English language together that makes any sense at all. So, I mean, I think in our public discourse now, the expectation isn't like perfect eloquence. And in fact, there's a value to not coming across too slick in that way. Just using plain words or even stumbling around a little bit is more human than being kind of that robotic lawyer who has every perfect choice of word. So I don't think you have to worry about that as much anymore. You don't have to be Cicero up there. You can be yourself. Another theme we've heard, and I would agree with, is that good, compelling visuals are really important, particularly in the modern era where people are accustomed to both seeing and hearing. Again, not an overwhelming number of things like that, but in every case, there'd be one or two key exhibits or one or two key visual aids that are kind of the centerpiece that the jury, they burn into the jury's brain and really help to communicate your case to them.
I think AI is going to help with that soon to make it even more cost-effective and maybe more compelling.
My partner's about to try a case next week, and just for fun, he had AI make him a man in a black suit image just to see what that would look like man in the black suit comes into hospital room with a briefcase of cash, and they did pretty well coming up with something there. I mean, AI is definitely, there's going to be impacts from that on our practice in ways that I don't think anybody can predict yet. We just had a bunch of speakers on that at our Florida meeting, and my big takeaway is there's a lot of stuff and nobody really knows exactly how it's going to affect anything yet. But it would be probably good to get out in front of that.
It's a lot of work to get out in front of it while it's on the exploratory phase, though. There's lots of great ideas. This may be the wrong state of mind, but I like to be in the middle of the pack. I don't want to be sitting on the way behind and then realize it's all come up on me and slapping me across the head while I'm now behind on things. But at the same time, there's just so much to look at. You could get frustrated and saturated at this stage in the game before anything really, really good comes out of it. So just kind of want to see and hear what the good ideas are. And then when they actually are there, I want to actually capitalize on them. But I don't know, have you been working really hard on trying to stay ahead of the times on all things AI?
I mean, I do have a ChatGPT account, and I was doing a legal research project on our Lewiston shooting case and wanted some background on other incidents involving the government and other mass shootings and regulations and hearings that have come out of those. And I did a couple prompts to ChatGPT, and it created a reasonably serviceable 4 or 5 page summary of that, which I plugged into my memo and footnoted that this came out of ChatGPT and everything needs to be confirmed and checked. But that has some value because you can have that done in literally minutes, and it can give you kind of a template for, okay, I should look up this statute or I should look into this incident. But in terms of any kind of major impact, no, we haven't embraced anything that would have a major impact on the practice yet.
There's some case management stuff that's coming around that'll take your documents and through AI automatically file them in the right place and then circulate them to the right members who are litigating on that case. So there are some automated tools out there that are pretty fantastic and only getting better. I know there's medical summary things that are coming together pretty nicely as well, which will hyperlink all the documents so that you can verify it in case you don't believe the summaries to be accurate, or you just want to see it with your own eyes. There are a lot of efficiency tools that are going to come out of this. But I think on trial graphics, circling back to that, that just seems like a real opportunity to kick it up to the next level.
Yeah, I mean, especially given trial graphics are very expensive right now, and there are different firms that can be more or less reasonable, but you're going to spend tens of thousands of dollars on high-level trial graphics. So if there's a way to accomplish that at a lower budget, that would be nice. I feel it's unlikely that AI is going to bridge that gap right away. I've tried to make some trial exhibits just messing around with it, and what they come up with is unusable. It might be okay for kind of an informal setting, or if you were going to do a speech and just wanted a slide to illustrate a cute point, but in the courtroom where you want to be really accurate and you also don't want to create unforced errors by doing anything that's remotely tone deaf or slightly, you know, inaccurate that can be criticized, I still think it's not quite precise enough for most cases to be usable, but I'm sure that will change soon.
Well, I did have one last controversial topic, but while we end this dialogue we've had, we've talked about the impact of jury verdicts that have been happening and maybe some contributing factors to that. Do you have any thoughts about the Trump effect and how that maybe impacted juror dynamics or people's states of mind?
I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that there's a lack of trust in institutions and in authority figures that is beneficial for plaintiffs among Trump jurors. I mean, an interesting thing in medical cases that came after the pandemic, the conventional wisdom was it would be very hard to win a medical malpractice case because doctors were perceived as being heroic during the pandemic and they were going in and putting themselves at risk to treat us and take care of us medically. And that's all true, actually. But we saw the reverse happen, which is that many people lost trust in institutions and in science-based decision-making overall, or were at least more willing to be skeptical of it and to listen to other points of view about it. And in some of our data studies, the Trump jurors have been better for plaintiffs in medical cases than the non-Trump jurors. And so, you know, just that can run through a lot of different types of cases. Like we were talking to Jamal on his Sutherland Springs shooting case, where he had a Trump-appointed judge, a Republican judge, who awarded his clients like $240 million in a claim against the U.S. government. And are you going to have that same success with a more liberal judge who probably has a higher sense of trust and confidence in our government versus a conservative MAGA type judge who may be more skeptical of the government? I mean, I would think you would want MAGA jurors on that jury because they're going to come in there with a healthy skepticism of the government of California and whether they're doing the right thing. They're not just going to accept what they say without a lot of skepticism and critique. I don't know. What do you think?
I've actually never thought about that issue either, but that actually does have some sense to it, especially in the state of California. If you've got a MAGA juror, then they probably just don't like the state of California, or they may have a potential to have some sort of feelings towards them. But I'm actually, I don't know. I'm going to find out. So I also just noticed that it seems like when Trump ran for president originally, there has been a invitation to have a little bit less political correctness, a little bit more direct dialogue of this is how I really feel. And that type of dialogue can probably transfer into the jury room, where some people maybe would have been a lot more quiet and just kind of gone with the flow. And I just have a feeling that people in those jury rooms now, if you've got that cross section of people, are just going to say what they really feel, even if it's controversial, even if it's maybe not right. And then that just is going to get a lot more discussion and animated discussion going on. And that probably did not happen as much or even close to as much before Trump. I feel like that might be one of the effects of him headlining things.
It's a good place to be because the traditional liberal jurors, Democrats, you know, people that are generally empathetic and have a worldview of wanting to help other people and give to other people, those jurors have historically been good for us. And to a large extent, they're still good for us. And now we have, instead of conservative business Republican mentality, we have the other side of it is now, well, I don't like corporations. I don't like authorities. I'm going to lash out and get you. And they're pretty good for us too. So now we're in the enviable position of potentially almost everyone can be pretty good for us. And the question, I guess, is how do you present the case so that it appeals to both sides of that spectrum without alienating one group or the other? I mean, I think the best approach to that is just kind of lay back. Don't project politics into it. Just lay back and give the facts. And people will draw from them whichever political perspective they have. It can map into their worldview as long as you don't force it into one versus the others. Just let it naturally go where the juror wants it to go.
Totally.
Well, this has been great, Rahul. I've really enjoyed doing this for 3.5 years with you. I feel like we've got plenty more we can continue to do. I know we've got some great guests that we've lined up now for the coming year, so I'm excited about that. And I feel like we should do this more often, too, where we just have a free-ranging conversation. Or we could even invite questions or listeners to come on with topics or something like that. If anybody has suggestions for format, we're open to it. Just email us and we can consider it.
This has been an absolute pleasure, Ben, and I'm glad we get to do this. And it's been one of the most rewarding things I've been doing over the last 3.5 years, and getting to do this with you and getting to meet so many fantastic trial lawyers and sharing experiences so everybody else can learn. So I'm glad we're doing this, and I'm glad we're going to continue to do it for a long time to come.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.